Lunch at Mach 30 is a work of Mach 30 Inc. and is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution License version 3.0. To learn more about Mach 30, visit us at mach30.org. For more information about Creative Commons licenses, see creativecommons.org. Email your questions, comments, and suggestions to lunch@mach30.org. Good afternoon. This is Lunch at Mach 30. It's April the 20th. This is Jay.
And this is Greg.
And last week, on April the 15th, President Obama announced his new policy for NASA's space exploration mission. And Greg and I have been rereading the speech and other policy documents and been thinking about it quite a bit. And we were going to use this afternoon to have a conversation about our thoughts and reflections on the policy and what it means for space exploration in general, what it means for Mach 30, what it means for NASA.
And so I guess before we get started, it would be important in light of our discussion here to give some more information on our background and about why Mach 30 is interested or how this affects Mach 30. So you can talk about a little bit of the core concepts behind Mach 30.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So the mission of Mach 30 is to hasten the advancement of humanity into a spacefaring civilization, literally to move us towards being able to expand out into space, similar to how seafaring nations in the 15th through 17th centuries expanded across the world from the old world to the new. And as part of that mission, we have three core values that we measure our programs and activities against. The first is sustainable leadership, which has a lot to do with not sacrificing your long-term goals to get short-term gains. The second is open design, which is the hardware and engineering equivalent to open source software, the idea that for these really big challenges in engineering, we should be sharing our designs with one another, because we'll move the state of the art forward faster that way and get better results. And lastly is a reliance on mature technology, that we shouldn't wait for a perfect new technology to come along before we start moving out into space.
That sounds like a good summary. This is the first time we've had an appetizer or chips or something, so there might be some crunching intermittently.
Yeah, as a reminder, if this is your first podcast with us, this is literally Lunch at Mach 30. Greg and I and whoever else wants to come, though it's usually just the two of us, record our podcast over our lunch together. So there will occasionally be waitresses coming and going, and today we have chips to crunch in your ears today. So there you go.
All right, so with that background, I was going to just say, start off by going over my overall impressions of the speech. I think that as the President of the United States, it's sort of his job to set the vision of his programs, and I think he did a really good job on that. It's definitely his, you know, his personal program and his ideas of what he thinks is best for this nation in space, and that came across strong to me. Now, it's of course different from past administrations, and some people might have strong opinions whether or not they agree with it, but as is his job to set the policy, I think this speech did a good job of explaining what he believed and what his thoughts were for NASA and why. So that's how I was going to say. He did a good job, whether or not you agree with it.
Right, right. And when I first listened to the speech, I remember thinking that it was a little light on detail. And in rereading the speech this morning for the podcast today, I do not feel quite as strongly that way. We were not in probably the most conducive environment to pay attention to the speech when it was live, so that might be part of it. I've also had a chance to go and find some of the little bit of policy documentation that's been published on this as well.
That's a good point. There was the speech itself, and if you go and look into it at any level of detail further than just this transcript, you can find a whole bunch of other policy documents and sort of the the background analysis that was done that led him to this policy. So
right.
I think you pointed me to some of the other fact sheets, and
there's a couple of high quality blog postings also that by some people in the industry that have also had time to reflect on this.
And do the fact checking.
Yeah. We're far from the first to weigh in. And I'll be sure to post links to all the material that we've been reviewing today on the podcast post. So if you're listening to this, take a look at mach30air.wordpress.com for a complete listing of the links we're talking about. You just want to go through the speech and point out elements that stood out, maybe take turns going back and forth?
Well, other than like the whole structure of how it was set up, the main themes that I got out of it were this whole, the idea of transformational, that his idea for NASA was not to be in the business of operating, you know, commercial space liners or, you know, regularly scheduled trips to an outpost. In his opinion, that's for commercial entities, businesses to set up a business around. But he points out at four or five different places in the speech, he's looking for transformational breakthroughs. He's looking for jumps in technology.
I would absolutely agree with that assessment, that he is trying to get NASA out of the business of operational space and into the business of pushing the boundary, of establishing what the current frontier is for space.
And so reflecting on the Mach 30 philosophy of mature technology, that's a very different mission. We're saying that, you know, space exploration should be done with, you know, currently available technology to become routine. And this policy says, well, there's other technology, and I think he even said that space is big, and so we want to push the boundaries, and to do that we'll need a lot of new technology which still needs to be developed.
Right. And I actually think there's a nuance there that I don't think it is so much about that the core philosophies are different. I think it is the assumption about where we are today with what state-of-the-art can achieve.
What do you mean by state-of-the-art?
What the current level of available technology in spaceflight buys us. That the president's plan, for those that aren't aware, is partly predicated on the idea that for access to low Earth orbit going forward, that is basic launch of astronauts to the station or up to the initial footsteps of space on way to other destinations, that America should be relying on commercial transportation operators, the beginnings of a version of the airlines for space, with the obvious potential market leader of that being SpaceX. In fact, SpaceX's Falcon 9 was called out by name in the speech.
They already have contracts with SpaceX to provide that service
for unmanned
or
service. They're on the way towards contracting development and provision of service for human spaceflight as well. And I would say that if in our reflection at Mach 30 that we had come to believe that spaceflight was routine and commercially viable to low Earth orbit, that we would have also looked out beyond to what was next. I think stepping stone missions leading up to Mars capability, the Augustine panel, in many ways the deep space component of President Obama's plan reflects many of the tenets of the Augustine panel or the Human Spaceflight Committee's report to do moderate distance extra Earth missions to asteroids and Lagrange points. Augustine panel then recommended going back to the moon before going on to Mars. President Obama is proposing going straight to Mars. But for the most part, this idea that when you head out in increments and you start off with non-gravity destinations before trying to get back into high gravity wells like Mars and the Moon. But I think that our assessment is that low Earth orbit has not been managed yet. That it is not necessarily a commercially viable destination yet. Whereas I think the president's plan is predicated on it being a commercially viable capability.
I don't really think it is. I think, well, as he said in his speech, we've already been to low Earth orbit and we've already been to the moon. So instead of developing the commercial business practices or the technology to make that routine and reliable, it's up to the commercial industry to do that.
Sure.
Now, NASA's goal or NASA's mission would be expand those boundaries. So beyond the moon, beyond low Earth orbit, and I think he even mentioned like he wants to be at an asteroid at
2025 to an asteroid. 2030 to Mars orbit,
right.
And somewhere in the 2030s to Mars surface.
Okay. So, and again, he's not saying that low Earth orbit is already operational, but he's saying NASA's job is not to make it operational. And I don't think you need low Earth orbit operational before these larger rockets are developed.
But you do need it. There's a difference between operational and commercially viable. Obama says specifically that, and I'm quoting here, by buying the services of space transportation rather than the vehicles themselves, we can continue to ensure rigorous safety standards are met, but we will also accelerate the pace of innovations as companies, from young startups to established leaders, compete to design and build and launch new means of carrying people and materials out of our atmosphere. And that's the end of the quote. In other words, that the market will move forward with technology and capability. But that only will happen if the market will see a return on investment for their research dollars. And right now, I'm not sure that will happen. In fact, historically, it hasn't happened yet.
Or it will continue to be subsidized. Right. Because, you know, NASA will continue to contract with these companies to provide the commercial access that they need. So.
Right, but then as soon as they provide the level of service that NASA needs, that NASA can pay for, unless they're going to see a greater return on investment for new research and development, they will not necessarily conduct that research and development.
Well, it depends on the company, I think, and its philosophy of internal R&D.
At the end of the day, they've got to make money. If they spend a bunch of money on R&D and they never see a return on it, they'll stop doing it, even if it's Elon Musk.
But you have places like Google who spend a lot of time and energy on R&D projects that never see the light of day in the hopes that...
They spend 10%. The rule is 10%. You can do any kind of cool research you want.
But I'm saying... For example, Google Apps, you know, some of these Google Apps that have people develop never make it out of the labs, even though, you know, the one or two of them that, out of the hundreds that do, are, you know, some are a hit and some are a miss.
Right, but all I'm saying is that's part of a very specific research and development structure
that
it does deliver return. They spend 10% of their hours working on new ideas, and they've figured out that for them 10% is a profitable, it's probably a highly profitable level of R&D. Generally speaking, the launch market has an inelastic demand, and so the market doesn't have market motivations to spend a large amount of money on making significant improvements in the technology. My concern is that we will not see this transference of buying services instead of vehicles will not lead to the downward spiral cost the president's predicting, because we are not at a place in the market where that can happen. And if that's the case, like I said, this is one of his key tenets, that this is how they're going to dramatically increase access to space, and I don't think it's going to, and I don't think right now it'll come to pass that way. Which is not to say SpaceX won't deliver a capable vehicle and be able to provide the launch services that are being requested of them to ISS, but the idea that that's going to then bring the cost down enough that there are a lot of other missions besides ISS missions is the part that I have doubts about.
Well, has yet to be seen, or
historically,
yeah,
not seen. And that's the disconnect, I think, is the belief that the market can fix this versus the belief that the situation supporting the market is not in a place to promote that happening yet.
Right.
Though the general deep space progression, I think, falls, like I said, I think falls very closely to the Augustine panel, and I think that, and I've commented on my blog, and I think a couple of times where I think that they did a really good job. In fact, we've been so impressed with it, we've adopted it for our 10, 20, 30-year plans as well. I don't think there's any reason to doubt that good quality work.
And now when you talk about the Augustine panel, I like their, I guess it's really not a new term, but their use of the term spacefaring and their definitions of that
really
match. But
they don't use spacefaring.
They don't use the term, but the concepts that they talk about all throughout the report really match. And the president, through his speech, has adopted some of that same language.
Yep.
In terms of going out into the solar system, exploring deep space beyond low Earth orbit, pushing the boundaries. And I think even in here, I don't remember the exact quote, but there's places where he talks about people living out in space indefinitely.
Yes, he did have a line about that towards the end of the speech, yes.
I'm looking for it here, but
it's near
the end.
I don't think I highlighted
that. Spacefaring. Our goal is the capacity for people to work and learn and operate and live safely beyond the Earth for extended periods of time, ultimately in ways that are sustainable and even indefinite. So that's right on.
Absolutely.
In terms of the what we're trying to do with spacefaring and the definitions for what we're looking at.
And so the big picture vision, I would say, is you're right, is completely in alignment with our big picture vision, this idea about humans moving permanently off-world, that there would be more than one planet in the solar system, more than one body in the solar system that humans lived on.
Depending on how you define planet.
Yeah. Sorry, Pluto. We'll let the astronomers debate what size of body is a planet.
Or was it the new definition that it has hundreds of planets in our solar system?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm an engineer, not an astronomer. So yes, I think you're right. The big picture vision, and again, I think that comes out of Augustine for the president's proposal, is what we've coined spacefaring. It's this idea that the reason you send humans into space at all is to make a path available for humans to move into space indefinitely, for there to be permanent colonies off-world.
So I was really excited when I heard that part. That was in the conclusion area, like the wrap-up of the speech. But right before he talked about return on investment for NASA in general. And I like some of the examples that he gave. Or his comment about liking Tang or whatever.
I'm going to leave Tang alone. That's a known myth.
But I suppose, looking at the policy, he has bigger concerns, like jobs and like return on investment for economics' sake, supporting up the space coast, the industry in general, keeping a viable manufacturing base for all these companies, and that sort of hits on that aspect of it. That NASA does a lot more than space exploration in terms of implementing its policies, impacting all these different areas.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, we agree on sort of the long-term reasons, and because we have slightly different means of doing it and other goals or other draws on our time than he has, time and resources, really.
Oh, to have just a tiny sliver of the budget of NASA.
But I guess that's one reason that the means are slightly different.
Yeah, I would agree. Certainly the elements such as the another part of the plan is to restart the Orion program, which is the capsule from the Constellation program. But make
that was
it
the portion of the system to return to the moon.
It was the crew capsule.
The crew capsule of the part that was going
yes.
to the moon.
Or just ISS. Orion would have done ISS missions as well. Yep. And the president's plan also calls for restarting Orion as a lifeboat vehicle for the ISS. And I'm sure part of that is about maintaining a continuity of jobs and of capability on the ground in terms of design and fabrication and construction. The assumption is that the next capsule that would be designed would then be a derivative of Orion instead of Orion itself, which would also leverage the engineering work that went into Orion.
So, yeah, I suppose when he talks about the next heavy lift rocket, that Orion would be an integral part of that as well.
Or whatever followed Orion.
The derivative of Orion,
yeah.
So that's it. That sort of narrows the scope in terms of concept of a rocket with a capsule on top kind of thing.
Yeah. Although if you look at, and the speech is a little light on the heavy lift rocket, there is a little bit more information in the policy document. So it might be more informative to take a look there if you want, in speaking about that. The idea would be before developing the rocket, they want to spend $3.1 billion over the next 5 years
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. On fundamental technology for heavy lift capability.
In
new
terms
propulsion
of
systems, new structures and stuff like that. That's not just the vehicle, it's the supporting technologies. It's significantly more efficient engines or lighter tanks or things like that, which would include, they're saying, a new first stage hydrocarbon engine, so something running either methane or RP1, aka rocket fuel. It's a form of kerosene, a very refined form of kerosene. They want to also explore new manufacturing techniques, combustion processes, etc.
Well, and again, this is the part of NASA that delves into immature technology.
Absolutely.
And advancing the TRLs, technology readiness levels, of the pieces of equipment and technology that's not ready yet to put into a current mission.
Right. I think my one concern here isn't doing that. I think it's absolutely essential to not only be developing systems with existing mature technology, but also at some reasonable pace, maturing immature technology to be available for future systems. So I'm all for that kind of research. In fact, we have a percentage of our time that is long-term supposed to be budgeted towards that at Mach 30. It's an essential element of long-term sustainable space exploration. My concern is that it's not just spending money on that R&D, which is good, but in 2015 they're also going to lock down on a design for a new actual heavy lift launch vehicle
and build it. He said that.
And build it. Yeah. That is hinged upon the technologies coming out of this R&D effort. And my concern is, if technologies do not mature at the pace that they want them to, that they will not meet that 2015 deadline to lock into a vehicle.
Well,
because if the vehicle is supposed to be reliant on these new technologies coming into existence, I think we're looking back at another Venture Star situation where you say, I'm forecasting 5 years from now, I'm going to figure out this propulsion system, and then I'm going to start trying, and I'm going to put it into this vehicle. And Venture Star died a slow, agonizing, expensive death because they didn't plan adequate time to mature those technologies.
Well, you know, you can have a whole bunch of development adages or management adages about it always takes longer than you plan, even if you plan it to take longer than you think.
Yes.
And so on and so forth. But the future is indeterminate. And,
right. But I think the difference is
I'm not sure that limiting yourself to one set of technology or planning on technology that's not available is inherently wrong. I just think that when you're doing that kind of thing, realizing it's a risk and a big risk, and then managing the project accordingly, because there's many examples of Venture Star as one that the program was not managed according to those kind of risk assessments.
Right.
The engine was not applicable, or it was the aerospike?
It was the linear aerospike and the composite cryogenic tanks. Combination of both of those technologies failing to mature on time led to an unsustainable program.
And so the importance is understanding the mature technologies and where they're at and their applicability to your system. So if it turns out that all of these leaps are made, these breakthroughs occur, this very well may be the next venture out into the solar system. But you have to manage it according to those risks. And if something is behind schedule or over budget, as some development processes may be, then that's when tough decisions are needed. Whether or not to cancel the big heavy lift rocket until these technologies are available, or scale the heavy lift rocket based on the technologies that you have. So it's a little bit about technology development, but I think a lot more on program management and the decisions that are made at the leadership level that
but let's be brutally honest for just a minute.
Yeah.
NASA's track record over literally the last 30 years has not been one to support that can be accomplished in NASA's culture. National Aerospace Plane, Venture Star, there was at least one other program between that and Constellation all succumbed to basically the same dilemma, which is this dilemma. Developing programs, intending to develop programs on technology you're in the midst of maturing, and then missing the time goals, and not being able to realize the vehicles. Which is, again, not to say that the maturing of technology is not a good thing, and it's not to say that pushing the boundaries of what you can do is not a good thing. But this whole, the deep space exploration is hinged on being able to develop the new heavy lift launcher. The new heavy lift launcher is based on being able to mature these technologies at the desired pace.
I guess the question
something that hasn't happened lately.
I guess the question is, can you really define the pace of technology advancement?
I don't think you. I think that's the issue.
You can't pin future development programs to technology maturation rates.
That
makes sense.
Which is where the core value at Mach 30 of reliance on mature technology came from. That if you want to be able to have a reliable program development, there are enough risks already in the program without managing the complete crapshoot that is, how long is it going to take me to mature this technology? And how much money is it going to take me to mature this technology? Because invariably, those things are wildly unpredictable. But if the programs that are supposed to develop vehicles are using mature technology, and you have a separate pool of research that is towards maturing technology, and as soon as technology pops out of that pipeline, you start moving it into systems, I think you still get to have those advanced systems that give you capabilities that were unimaginable a decade ago without having to go through the great pain that is VentureStar.
That's a very philosophical and theoretical way of looking at it, and I'm sure that will work, although it's definitely, that requires, I think, a lot, I don't know how to say this. I don't know if the resources required would be any different. The independent path of developing mature technology systems, independent of this technology maturation tree and waiting for the outcome of the technology maturation, I think would probably, in NASA's case, this is strictly for NASA's policy and its programs, I don't know if that would save them any money. I know space programs are inherently very expensive, but to run two complete independent paths is much more redundant. And the NASA way of doing things, putting together a huge program, standing it up based on future technology, and then spinning up sub-programs to support it, in their mind is more efficient because they're not two redundant paths. It's a single path with sub-programs or supporting programs. And the results of those programs feed directly somewhere. So they're always feeding something. There's a reason for developing these things. Whereas if you have a pure technology maturation program, there's no reason to be doing it. Sure, other than for the
sure there is.
Building
you
a better
still have,
efficiency.
No. You still have the desire for heavy lift capability, for heavier lift capability than we have today. Having an engine that is twice the thrust to weight ratio of any current modern engine, there's an obvious use of that. You don't have to have a system to stick it in.
That's exactly my point. There are no systems that are going to use it. Therefore, how do you make the case for needing it?
Well, that's part of if you know you have on your timeline to go to Mars and that you need more lift capacity long term than you have now, you have a need for enabling technologies for heavy lift. I don't think that changes anything, but I think waiting to go to the Lagrange points until you have the necessary technology to launch something that could go to Mars is perhaps a hang-up, because you're talking about developing a system that is the infrastructure system for Lagrange, asteroids, Martian orbit, Martian landing. And it'll probably be upgraded during its lifetime, but you're still talking about basically the same system, it sounds like.
Well,
of course, the details are extremely thin right now, so who really knows?
Right.
I keep waiting for additional details about what the vision for this heavy lifter is.
I don't think they're developed yet, or they don't even know yet.
That could very well be.
But they already have systems out at Lagrange points. We have already put sensors and space weather equipment. And solar observation points.
Yes, absolutely.
At the various Lagrange points.
But we haven't done anything
that technology, crude. Exactly. That technology is not, or the technology needed to man those points or to put stations or crewed missions is very different.
Right, but that's a much smaller step to human rate our current level of heavy lift capability. And
I don't know about that. I don't think the heavy lift capability to put the payloads out there, I don't think that would work for cruise systems. I don't think the mass of the payload compared, out at the Lagrange point would not be sufficient for manned systems.
I have to go look up what some of those
SOHO, Observatory, Helios,
and SOHO, the solar observatories that are sitting out at the Earth-Sun Lagrange points.
Right.
Yeah. I'd have to go look up how big they are. But they're not small.
I don't know. You're right.
I bet they're measured in the tons.
I don't know.
And you need a couple of tons per person for a short-duration mission. All I'm saying is that is closer to within reach than literally a breakthrough engine. In the last 30 years, we have not broken through the current thrust-to-weight barrier of engine performance.
Okay. I'd buy that.
That's a shorter hop is all I'm saying. And certainly to probably start lifting huge amounts of mass to go to Mars or even to go to an asteroid.
Right.
Yes, we're going to either have to have something that's of current launch capacity but can fly a lot more often, or something that is of far greater capacity. And that's, either way, that's some breakthroughs.
Right.
For some is either a small or a large number, but that's some breakthroughs. We could aim lower technologically speaking and start to push into the closer boundaries, is all I'm saying, without pinning the entire program on some number of breakthroughs,
sure.
Literal breakthroughs.
Sure.
So.
Well, I think we probably hammered that topic to death. And
I can't imagine why. Mature technology is one of the major things that gets us going. So.
And I'm sure we could go on or have a whole bunch of other topics spin off from that one, but I was going to see if you had any other points in the speech that you'd like to mention here.
This has been harped on by others, but I do want to echo my agreement that Constellation was an interesting idea and showed some promise, but as they started to implement it, as the president said, it was not fulfilling its promises in many ways. And I think it was the right call to take a program that was not going to deliver and shut it down before you spent even more money on it. I think it's always a hard call to do that, but
absolutely.
I think it's very important to, if you come to that realization, to let it go. I am sorry for the people working on Ares that their program has been canceled, but I think that that's the right call. There was one other thing that I thought might be worth chatting a little bit about, and that was, it's this tiny line early in the speech. He says that broadening our capabilities in space will continue to serve our society in many ways that we can scarcely imagine.
Whoa, slow down.
Sorry. Because broadening our capabilities in space will continue to serve our society in ways that we can scarcely imagine, because exploration will once more inspire wonder in a new generation.
There we go.
That's
an important point. I think he hits that inspiration aspect several times early in the speech, and of course referencing back to NASA's heyday in the 60s, inspiring an entire generation, which went to the moon. He's trying to pull that same kind of emotion out of today's engineering force, which may or may not have the same, motivations for spaceflight. But
you said an interesting turn of phrase: an entire generation that went to the moon. It was 12 men that went to the moon. 18, if you count the commanders aboard the orbiter, and a few more if you count all the orbiting-only missions. But people that walked on the moon, it was 12 men.
And they certainly
inspired a generation, but I wonder, why was that inspirational to an entire generation?
Because it was broadcast into every home, generalizing again. Most people had TV sets, and it was a huge deal to see the broadcasts of NASA's astronauts setting foot onto the moon. And most people were highly attuned to the progress of NASA and the accomplishments that they were making, and staying in touch with the progress. on maybe not a daily basis, but definitely
frequently,
week to week, month to month, checking in on what were the NASA astronauts up to this month.
And you had Walter Cronkite narrating the entire thing, it seems like.
And I had highlighted an interesting part here in the speech. He says something about what was once a global competition has long since become global collaboration. And so the motivation that was there is different than the motivation is today. And so the competitive nature of beat the Russians, this is a national priority, has sort of decreased in lieu of a more cooperative, collaborative, humanitarian mission, if you want to call it that.
Right.
So that was another comment that I had too. But I liked the inspirational aspect of it.
The trick is, how do you make sure that that's really the output? How do you make sure that's actually one of the things that happens? Because I don't think that it has happened like that. Really, during the shuttle era.
How do you make it inspirational? That's a great question.
And probably, I would be very disappointed in us.
That might be another topic for.
I think it's got to be
a new podcast.
I think that's another podcast. But just real quick, initial reflections. I think I would be very disappointed in us as a species if the first people to walk on Mars was not inspirational. But one could almost imagine it happening.
Yeah.
And because of that, I wonder if the missions to asteroids, Lagrange points, Martian orbit, would they get noticed more significantly and be more inspirational to the public than the shuttle missions and ISS. I mean, go look at pictures of the ISS now. She is an amazing thing to behold.
I guess I can't speak on that because I am extremely inspired, but, and have desktops and screensavers. Backgrounds on my phone that are space
all space related.
So yeah. I don't think we're the right audience for having that kind of market survey or whatever.
Yeah, but you see what I'm talking about though is that you can.
Yep.
One could be perhaps disillusioned about having watched the last 30 years of human spaceflight and the general American reaction about, well, what does it take to be inspirational these days?
And maybe it truly is a long-duration space mission to an asteroid that is clearly pushing technological limits, that pushes humanity to the edge and to push itself out into space. As opposed to reusable launch vehicles to low Earth orbit might not have that same kind of truly pushing the limits of human expansion. Although it clearly does in terms of daily living. Everybody's not going to go out into deep space. So it might not clearly be.
That's, I think there's a
common piece
that we're missing from the era because we didn't live through it.
Yep.
And I think part of it is to go talk to people that lived through it. But the 60s are also the era of movies like 2010.
Yep.
And science fiction that promoted the idea that a spacefaring culture, and like fully realized spacefaring culture where the airlines are running trips to low Earth orbit every day and people book business trips to the moon, is right around the corner. We are decades late on fulfilling the promises of the 60s. But if in that era, can you imagine what it must have been like to go from the 50s, where it was all Buck Rogers, where science fiction was almost high fantasy in the way it was received and the way it was perceived by the public, to Sputnik, to Yuri Gagarin, to the Mercury 7, and then having movies come along and stories come along like 2010 and some of the Ray Bradbury stuff, and have it move into this idea where you're just a handful of decades away from being able to buy a ticket to the moon like you buy a ticket to London. and now in that frame of time put in the Apollo program. This isn't just a race to the moon to beat the Russians. It's the groundwork. It is perceived as the groundwork to making 2001 a reality.
The movie.
The movie 2001 a reality, which means that I might walk on the moon before I die.
And I don't know, like you said, having not lived through the era, I don't know what their motivation was. I'm not sure if having the dream to go into space regularly was a motivating factor as opposed to fear, which was a very strong motivating factor. Yeah, we should make a note of that and look into that more.
Because if it winds up that it's not inspirational, it'll be very hard to keep the budget increases that the president's talking about, and to go back to the mundane from high talking about 2001 A Space Odyssey to the mundane. One of the essential elements of President Obama's plan is a dramatic increase in the budget of NASA, 20% or something like that, 5%, 6 billion over 5 years, and it's a 5% annual increase, I think. That's what it was, but it's still in the current budget climate, that's a big deal, and it's not small amounts of money. But you'll have a hard time keeping that increase if you don't wind up being inspirational.
Yeah.
So, all right, we'll probably beat this to death for the day. I think.
I guess to transition out, I just saw one of the TVs here at the restaurant had CNN on and news of the Discovery's landing. So, 131 down, 3 to go.
Yes.
We have any other motivation beyond that? That's all cake, gravy, icing on the cake.
Yeah, there you go. If you need, if those of us that are already committed to space exploration and the human expansion into space need any more inspiration to get off our butts and start working for real, if we aren't already, or to redouble our efforts, it's that we have 131 shuttle flights down and only 3 left before. We don't have a shuttle program. All right. Well, thank you all very much. And we'll catch you next week.